You're listening to Arrivé by the Cycling Podcast.
Well, Lionel, the classics, the spring classic season is over. And did it conclude? Has it concluded with the sexiest classic yet of the spring?
Well, in this episode, we'll be looking forward to the Tour of Romandy, which starts on Tuesday. No, we won't. I did joke just before we press record here, Daniel, that we could have recorded this episode on Friday morning and we'd have been broadly right, apart from all of the drama in the first couple of hours that we didn't see, because I assumed that Liège-Bastogne-Liège was broadcast from start to finish. And it was only when I settled down with all my snacks and drinks this morning for another 6+ hours in the armchair that it came back to me that ASO and the Belgian organ, the Belgian broadcasters, they generally join the race with around about 150k to go, don't they? I remember being out there.
Usually more than enough. More than enough.
Which is normally, yeah, much more than enough, because Liège-Bastogne-Liège, being as hard as it is, what would we have ordinarily expected? We would have seen a group of six away, three of them from Wanty Group Gobert, and two from Baloise Flanders, maybe, or one from Europe Car, if we're going back that far.
And Lionel, this is a race where in the not too distant past we've seen breakaways with 10+ minutes.
It's that kind
of race.
But we haven't seen a breakaway with one of the big three pre-race favourites and the winner of the Amstel Gold Race from the previous Sunday in there. And Remco Evenepoel in that early split was surprising. And I was clamouring, as a lot of people were, come on, give us the pictures. But in a way, it was quite charming. It was like an old school flashback to the days of covering cycling when you really didn't know what was happening and you resorted to phrases in written race reports like, after a series of attacks, a break finally went clear.
In short, when we could just make it all up, which is what we're going to do in a minute.
Well, so no, stay because tuned. We've got eyewitness testimony from the voice of Radio Tour, Seb Piquet.
Someone behind one of the grassy knolls of the Ardennes.
Yeah, he was in the hot seat, probably best seat in the house, isn't it? And so, I mean, if he doesn't know what happened, and to be fair, he's not entirely sure what happened, if he doesn't know, then the only people that will know will be the riders. But I think as the race comes out in the wash, we'll probably come to the conclusion that, yes, it was a really interesting split with 52 riders up the road, including Remco Evenepoel and his Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe teammate Nico Dents, and obviously 50 other riders. But did it impact on the race result? Probably not. Did it deaden Remco Evenepoel's the spring in his pedal stroke when it really mattered? We can only speculate on that.
Yeah.
But it certainly made for an interesting race to follow in those first couple of hours when it was just back to pro cycling stats and the Le Tour website text coverage.
Well, there'll certainly be time later to analyse, for example, Remco Evenepoel's race. Who knows, Lionel? Later on, we may even be speaking to another influential Frenchman. Who knows? You know, in the vein of recent podcasts, who knows? Who can say?
Is Emmanuel Macron waiting?
Let's not spoil that. We will spoil the result of the race and tell you that Tadej Pogacar, if you haven't already grasped, if you haven't already watched the race, he won his third monument of the spring. This afternoon, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, his fourth victory in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, La Doyenne. And Lionel, well, we've already started to talk there about the huge incident or unforeseen circumstance which really conditioned a large part of the race. So let's get into the sort of blow-by-blow now, shall we, and tell people exactly what did happen, to the best of our knowledge and to the best of our spies, our on-course spies' knowledge.
Yeah, well, there was a crash, wasn't there, in the early stages, very early stages.
2 kilometres.
Izaguirre of Cofidis. But Seb Piquet doesn't think that the crash actually caused the split, because he says that there were 25 riders already away at that point. But it definitely had an impact, and then another 25 riders or so went across, and I've got photographic evidence of this. In those opening kilometres, Tadej Pogačar in his rainbow jersey was right near the back of the peloton. Seb Piquet was able to take a photograph of Pog at the back. And so there's some debate about how soon they realised that this split had happened, and especially how soon it was that they realised that Remco Evenepoel was in it.
Do you know, my first thought was that the rest of the peloton, Pog included, the second part of the peloton, had assumed that Remco, Pinocchio, Evenepoel had been telling lies again about participating, and they didn't actually believe that he was in the race, and therefore they'd allowed it to go.
Very possibly, very possibly. Seb Piquet also says that UAE Team Emirates riders, teammates of Pogačar, of course, Tim Wellens and Vigard Stekelengen, were originally in the front group, but they went back, leaving just one UAE Team Emirates rider up there. That was Domen Novák. The only team to miss the split and not have anyone up there at all was Decathlon, Paul Seksas's team, of course. And so the pattern was set very early, and the gap went up to quite a surprising 3.5 minutes, and after a couple of hours it was almost 4 minutes, but not quite. But as we heard from Pogačar at the finish, they realised after 20 minutes or so that actually it didn't really need to force them to rip up plan A. They could still race the race. They had Evenepoel up the road, but was it all going to stay clear? If it was, as long as they kept it sort of a couple of minutes, 2.5 minutes or so after the turn at Bastogne, they would probably be okay. And that's more or less what happened.
Yeah, I think a lot of us following the race on social media, because we were all following the race on social media at that point, we expected to turn on our TVs to pandemonium, to an anarchical situation, and to sort of see that in the faces of the riders and what was happening on the road. And I think it's just sort of based on what you've just said, and also listened to a few post-race interviews, it sounds as though after 20 minutes or so, both groups, both the front group and the Pogačar group, sort of reconciled themselves to the fact that it was a kind of normal-ish, it was going to be a normal-ish race configuration. The only difference being that there were a huge number of riders up there, 50 riders. And we believe, Lionel, we saw a little bit of this, certainly the tail end of it, but there were teams working, obviously. UnoX were very well represented in that front group, so they were contributing certainly to the pacemaking. Ineos Grenadiers were as well. We're not entirely sure how much work Nico Denz was doing, because of the first thought, sort of all joking aside, when you see Remco Evenepoel in that group, you think this is his golden opportunity. On social media, I called him Walco Evenepoel after Roger Walkowiak, who won the Tour de France in the 50s with what they call a fuga bidone in Italian, sort of a fluky break. I was being facetious, of course, but that's what you kind of imagine might happen, that Denz might force the pace, and that's how Remco was going to win his third Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Yeah, I think it was more opportunistic than kind of planned, wasn't it? Because if it was a strategy, Remco Evenepoel would have wanted more than just one teammate in there, Nico Denz. And perhaps that's the thing they'll reflect on, is like, if we'd all been together in that very early few kilometres, and, you know, we talk about the importance of teammates all riding together and sometimes wonder why they're doing it in, you know, either the very early stages of the race or seemingly nothing stages of the race. If there'd been another two even, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe riders, that might have changed the complexion of it completely. Little Trek had three riders in there, Bernard, Mosca and Verona. Groupama had three riders in there. UnoX, as you said, Magnus Cort, Kamp and Leknesund, probably the strongest trio there. Egan Bernal and Laurens de Plus for Ineos Grenadiers. Dylan Van Baarle and Louis Verweijke for Soudal Quickstep. So there were potential podium riders, maybe even race winners in there. You wouldn't want to give Bernal and Evenepoel in particular a four-minute head start. But you're right, when the TV pictures arrived, they were riding pretty hard on the front of the first group. But it was all very controlled in the second group. UAE had got themselves organised. Hedegaards and Lengen were riding on the front. Standard Wolf was also contributing quite a lot for Decathlon. And it was all kind of under control. They'd had a tailwind, of course, down to Bastogne. And although it didn't sort of swing round and hit them in the faces to a huge extent on the way back, I mean, that probably accounts for such a fast start. I think they did They did 90 kilometres in the first 2 hours.
Mm. Yeah, I think I saw 48 kilometres now for the first hour, and it continued. It continued in that vein, which suited Pogacar. We've been talking so much about this in recent months that is the pattern of racing that he wants. In fact, for example, Cosnefroid confirmed this after the race, that the situation sort of suited them pretty well, and it was pretty much plan A for them. And when the TV pictures did come online, I think you said they were around 140 kilometres to go, and the start of this race, the start of the sort of hostilities, that's really marked by the Côte de Juan, and then you get the sequence of Stockholm. Am I going to get the order wrong? It's Stockholm, and then Haute-Levée. Yes, and there we saw that the peloton, okay, it had been sort of thinned out. Wellens had apparently done a monumental amount of work in bringing back the break. And therefore, because the pace was so high, because UAE had probably had to use up a little bit more manpower than they would ordinarily, it was a smaller peloton. We'll discuss this later, I suppose, but that may have made things a little bit easier, not just for Pogacar, but for a lot of people in terms of the positioning going into the key points of the race, the La Redoute, for example. But we saw on those key climbs, the sort of the trilogy of key climbs, Stockholm, Juan, Haute-Levée, we saw Sivakov in particular on the front doing a lot of work and doing hard work as well.
Yeah, I mean, Sivakov did a real solid hour riding very, very hard on those climbs. But it was that approach to the Côte d'Juan where quite a lot seemed to happen all of a sudden. You know, it was obvious that the two groups were going to come back together, but the question was, would they all come back together before the Côte d'Juan, or would they survive? Would anyone, you know, chip away and maybe force a group over the top of the Côte d'Juan and keep it interesting? At 113k to go, Tom Pidcock had a mechanical at the worst time possible, a bike change, and that really ruled him out. So that put him in a pretty small group of chasers behind the second of the two big groups. With about 100k to go, four riders from the front group went away. That was Alexander Kamp of Uno X, Pascal Inkhorn of Sudal Quickstep, Hayes Lehmreiser of Picnic, and Ugo Uhl of Daniel. Help me out.
Ugo Uhl is Alpecin.
Alpecin, that's right. Yes, he is now. And well, there was a bit of jumping about with Evenepoel and Bernal, on the way to the Côte d'Juan. Weisstrofer got across to that front quartet, made it five, and they were still almost a minute clear approaching the Côte d'Juan, but the two groups behind had all come together. And then on the first of the climbs after the turn for home, the brake started to fracture. Eekhoorn and then Weisstrofer would drop, leaving three at the front. And then on the lowest slopes of the Stockau, the second climb, that is where Sivakov brought it all back together. He was on the front, riding very hard. And ominously, UAE still had Novak and Cosnefroid sitting in front or either side of Pogacar. So they were well in control at this stage. And you were left wondering, well, has Remco has he had a nice, comfortable ride in that group of 50? Or has he been in the wind? You know, what's the toll been on him? Has he had an easier day than Pogacar at this stage? It was a real unknowable question, really. But we then had a real flat phase of the race. I mean, I think the only thing I made a note of was that Max Schachmann made a very short-lived little move. He was away for a couple of kilometres. And then it's a case of just counting down those next three climbs to the La Redoute.
Yes, and you mentioned Lionel, the riders that were left for UAE. So Sivakov, they lost him after the turn he'd done on the Stockholm. And then they had Novak, who had been in the break earlier on, but he'd come back and he was still looking strong. And Cosnefroid was clearly, he had been earmarked for this job. So the Narvaez role in previous years, last year, the last lead out. Philippe Gilbert had been talking in the press this week. Philippe Gilbert, of course, former winner of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, he knows the race very well. He'd been talking about the value of having that guy who, okay, he's not good enough to win the race, but after 220 kilometres, the bottom of La Redoute, can simply do 400 metres, 300 metre sprint. And that is what Cosnefroid is good enough to do. He's not good enough to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So that was going to be his role. And, you know, they were missing the likes of Narváez, McNulty. So Cosnefroid, not maybe accustomed to that role, but there he was in position. Laurent Jalabert on French TV had a nice line just as they were coming down the descent of the Côte de Denier, so into the bottom of La Redoute. He said he saw Pogacar and Cosnefroid talking. He said, look, they're tuning the violins. And so it proved. I mean, that descent line, I think it's really deceptive on television because it looks like a wide road and they're clearly descending. They're clearly going fast. But I've read some stuff in the press this week about just how much the riders fear that descent. And in fact, I think Maxime Montfort, who's also from that neck of the woods, direct sportif at Little Trek, he said this week that he thinks that should be taken out of the race. It's so dangerous. And again, you don't really see it on TV, but apparently the surface is bad. And there are a lot of riders who are petrified at that point in the race. Obviously, it's strategically really important as well. And this is where we saw Remco. We thought Remco kind of lost the race last year because he got completely out of position. And he looked as though he was in good position right onto the bridge going into Remouchon. And then all of a sudden, he was 10th wheel, whereas Pogacar was where he wanted to be behind Cosnefroid, and Seixas was on Pogacar's wheel.
Yeah, I thought Cosnefroid did a brilliant ride through those turns because it looks fantastic from the overhead shot, doesn't it? The going over the bridge and then that left and right, and then there's another little left and right, isn't there, a bit further on before it kicks up properly. And I mean, I don't want to put myself in the position of riders racing Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but I have actually done the sportive, Daniel, and I can definitely say that descent is sketchy. It is fast, and you know, it's one of those ones where, you know, amateur cyclists really have to be right on, you know, sort of dial it back a bit. But in a race, they can't do that because as we had the camera shot from the back, you can sort of see the riders trying to give themselves a little bit more room to get through those, you know, get down that bit and then through the corners without coming to any grief. And I thought Cosnefroid did a great job leading through there. Then there was the Bahrain rider, Eulalio, who was in there as well, wasn't he? He was looking really good. And Pogacar got onto the bottom of La Redoute in absolutely A1 position. And before we knew it, Remco Evenepoel was slipping back. Pretty surprising. I thought he was looking good. I couldn't really say at that point he's paying for the efforts made earlier in the day. I don't think it was that. I just think the pace was so hot.
It was very similar to last year, and you know, this week again, the clips of his winning attacks when he did win Liège-Bastogne-Liège, was the last one 2022 or 2023. Anyway, you go back and watch those, and it almost defies belief that he's now unable to follow these attacks from Pogacar today and last year, because he just looks extraordinarily good on La Redoute. On the occasions when he did win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But today was really an action replay of last year where he lost the wheels very quickly, so much so that I thought he was imploding, I thought he was capitulating and he would finish minutes down. That wasn't the case, as we'll find out. But Pogacar launched pretty much the same attack as last year, the difference being that it was Seixas on his wheel. And we had a duel then, Lionel. The Italians sort of have mythologized and the Belgians have mythologized this edition of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but very similar, reminiscent for me of 1999 with Frank van den Broek and Michele Bartoli.
My eyebrows are raised so high, wow, though, over the back of my head at that.
Wow.
I think, I mean, Pogacar looked amazing. I mean, his acceleration was so fast, but Seixas looked equally good, although he is too tall for cycling, isn't he?
Go.
I mean, you know, he looks like he's wrestling the bike a little bit more than Pogacar. I mean, he was obviously working incredibly hard to stay on the wheel. There was that lovely moment where he kind of drew, perhaps sort of level with Pogacar's elbow, and then Pogacar just nudged forward again. But the two of them were head and shoulders above the rest. I mean, there was a real wow moment when it cut back to the overhead shot and we saw Skelmoser. And then the next group, you know, they looked almost pedestrian in comparison. to the front two at that stage. And it wasn't as if they weren't trying or going quickly. It was just no one had anything left to give. And from that point, Remco Evenepoel started to look quite frustrated. I thought it was telling that his teammate Jai Hindley was the one that was trying to go clear and sort of concertina it all back up together. But Laredo's so long and so hard that once that gap's opened, very, very difficult to see it coming back together after that, especially the strength of Pogacar. And we just didn't know how good Seksas was going to be and how far towards the finish he would get.
35 seconds was the gap between those two and Skelmoser at the top. Like, I was monitoring the numbers. I was watching the France television live feed, and I was monitoring the numbers of live spectators. And obviously, these live feeds, they don't get millions of spectators because most people are watching on terrestrial TV. But it had been 22,000 just before Laredo, and within minutes, it was 39,000. So everyone had been sort of rushing to their laptops or turning on their live.
They'd heard something was happening in the Ardennes. French cycling is waking up from quite a slumber.
Yeah. And as far as, well, we knew then the winner was going to be Pogacar or Seksas. We thought it was probably going to be Pogacar, but the big question was, can Pogacar dislodge him? Can he drop Seksas? We suspected there were a couple of climbs still to go. We expected it would be on the final climb, the Rochefort-Fourcon. I felt that Seksas had, you could see, although I think he was trying to give Pogacar a bit of a poker face, you could see that he'd probably done himself so much damage to stay in Pogacar's wheel, particularly on those last sort of 300 metres of Laredo, that I did fear for him. I felt that he was sort of hanging by a bit of a thread. And then, well, shall we fast forward? There was a lot of movement in the group behind. At one point, it looked as though Skelmoser was clearly the strongest in that group and was going to go away. Well, there were a couple of times where it looked as though he was going to ride away on his own. That didn't happen. But then a bit of sort of group two syndrome kicked in. But then, despite the TV director's best efforts not to show Pogacar and Seksas, he seems fixated on group two. Then they came to La Roche-aux-Fourcons. And Lionel, unfortunately, Air France was shot down by the RAF.
Oh yeah, I mean, he cracked, didn't he?
You're not even gonna ask me to explain that.
The RAF,
Rochefort-Fourcon.
Oh, very good.
There you go.
Very good. Yeah. You obviously scripted that, but very good.
They were calling it the RAF all day on French TV, and I wasn't familiar with this meme, but yeah, I quite liked it.
Well, he got to 580 metres from the top, but then the gap opened and he was wrestling his bike quite significantly at that stage, wasn't he, Seksas? And Pogacar just looked so smooth, you know, just sort of coasting away. It was obviously the moment. I mean, the Rochefort-Fourcon is an incredibly difficult climb as well. I mean, it's so steep in places. And Seksas, I mean, he'd done so well to get to that stage and still be in with a shout. I did wonder at that point whether he would crumble, collapse. I mean, that would have been a possibility, but the gap was enough and he managed to gather himself and ride in. Because that section after the climb, where it goes onto that horrible false flat, it's real unpleasant surface to ride on. And I have to say, the first time I've seen crowds that big on that section. Normally that's kind of a bit of a wasteland there. It's quite empty and open, but the crowds have really come out. Glorious weather in the Ardennes today. A real great day to see some of the best riders. And Seksas dug in deep. Not that we saw an awful lot of that. Meanwhile, Skelmoser was, well, he was involved in the ultimate chasse patate, wasn't he? The potato chase. I mean, there was chips, baked potato and mash, because he was just riding, riding and riding and getting nowhere. And eventually he got caught with about 3K to go to the finish. And we had the biggish bunch sprint for third place behind Pogacar and Seksas.
Won by Remco Evenepoel. A sort of unexpected, given what we'd seen over the previous sort of 40 minutes. Unexpected third place for him. We'll discuss, Lionel, I want your views in the second part on whether this has been a good, an excellent, or an indifferent spring for Remco Evenepoel, because I think it's kind of an intriguing question. But anyway, let's give the results, and then we will move on to more analysis in the second part. And Tadej Pogacar, won in a time of 5 hours 50 minutes 28 seconds. That was an average speed of 44.4. Do we know whether that was a record? It probably was.
It was by a couple of k's an hour, I think. Wow. Plus, yeah.
Paul Sexas second, 45 seconds only behind at the end. Of course, Pogacar probably lost a few seconds because he was celebrating. Remco Evenepoel third, a real sort of breakout rider of the spring. Emil Vestringer of Alpecin Premier Tech was fourth. Egan Bernal, who did a pretty good sprint, fifth. Ineos Grenadiers. Peyo Bilbao, Bahrain victorious, was sixth. Romain Grégoire of Groupama was seventh. Scaroni of Astana was eighth. Tobias Holland-Johannessen of Uno X was ninth. And Filippo Zana of Sudal Quickstep was 10th. I'm just going to go down to 11, and well, I'll go down to 13. Mauro Schmidt was 11th, despite being in absolute Narnia, Neverland, at the bottom of La Redoute. Leo Bissio, who has been excellent in recent weeks, and young teammate of Paul Sexas, he was 12th, and Ben Chulett was 13th. All of these chaps were on the same time. In fact, that was a pretty big group that came in, the Remco group, because Steph Kras was the last rider from that group, and he was in 24th, so that was 21 riders.
Yeah, Paul Sexas's impressive young teammate, Leo Bissio, in fact 2 years older than him at 21. But the way that Sexas has kind of turned cycling on its head in the last month is quite extraordinary.
More sexy talk in part two.
Oh dear.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, Lionel, we are going to dive into the blossoming Pogacar Sexas rivalry. Forget Vingegaard. it's all about Sexas and Pogacar now, which is kind of inconvenient for us because we're going to talk about Jonas Vingegaard for the next 4 weeks at the Giro d'Italia. But yes, we're going to talk about it in a minute. But just one thing before we do, if we go right back to the start of today's race, and as discussed earlier, we don't know exactly what happened, but it sounds as though Pogacar was sort of, well, he wasn't really paying that much attention to what was going on, or he was, you know, kind of loitering, lingering at the back, and this split happened. This is something that I've always kind of observed and wondered about. When you go to races, you see some riders who are in the habit of being at the back of the grid. They kind of arrive at the start late, or they just like sort of loitering, lingering at the back. And of course, then there's a neutralized zone. And the neutralized zone, in theory, it should leave ample time, although neutralized zones vary massively in length. They can be 2 kilometers, they can be 15 kilometers. Generally speaking, they should leave time for riders to go back to the front and find their position. Pogacar is usually on the front line because he's usually presented in some form, whether he's in the leader's jersey or he's the defending champion. So he's usually on the front line. There have been a few famous occasions in cycling history when people have been caught out. Luis Ocaña in the 1971 Tour de France, the very famous stage to Marseille where they arrived 2 hours early, one of the fastest stages ever in the Tour de France, certainly at that point. Eddy Merckx caught him speaking to journalists, of all things. And he thought, oh, this is a good opportunity to attack him because he's going to be late. And we often see this, don't we? We see riders leave for races, sometimes minutes behind the caravan. In fact, Mark Cavendish has got a whole story about almost having to cheat in a Giro d'Italia stage. It's in his latest book. Because he completely missed the start. And he didn't realise the race had left town. This was somewhere on the Tuscan coast. And he was stuck on a pier. And he couldn't get out of this VIP enclosure. And there was quite a large sort of lap to start the race. And at one point, he contemplated maybe not doing the lap and infiltrating the peloton when they'd done 20 kilometers or so. He didn't do that. He didn't cheat. But I wonder if that was the case with Pogacar. I wonder how he missed this. I mean, he wasn't the only one, of course. Most of them missed it.
Well, maybe because the pattern of Liège-Bastogne-Liège is that the early break is usually riders from the wildcard teams and the smaller of the World Tour teams and the non-World Tour teams as well. So I suspect, you know, the urgency wasn't quite there. It is quite a long way. They've got to go all the way to Bastogne and back. Yeah. And there's not usually anything to be too concerned about. And I suspect if Remco hadn't been in that split, they wouldn't have been at all worried. You know, they you don't want to give a rider like Egan Bernal that advantage, but it wouldn't have had quite the same, you know, orange lights flashing on the dashboard. But, you know, they didn't panic, did they? And they kept it well under control. And in a way, perhaps, it meant that it was all quite neatly and quite compact as they reached a turn and headed towards the major climbs. Yeah. You know, they weren't trying to ride down 8, 9, or 10 minutes, which, although it wouldn't have changed what UAE would have to do, it might have changed what some other teams wanted to do. Mm. So it probably worked out pretty well for them.
Yeah, yeah. So, Lionel, we're going to talk about this Pogacar Sexas duel, which was certainly the highlight of today. And it was genuinely exciting. I mean, we've maligned Liège-Bastogne-Liège a lot over the years. And today you really felt that this duel today particularly gave the race new luster in it. And in a classic season that has given us a series of really exciting races, Liège-Bastogne-Liège was not the sort of bum final note, the anti-climax that it's been in the classic season in recent years. This was certainly on Laredo and Rochefort-Quarant. This was heart-stopping stuff, particularly for the French fans. And, you know, the speed at which this sort of sex-ass hype train has travelled over the last few weeks, it's just been quite extraordinary. I mean, I was glad he didn't win today for a couple of reasons. For his own benefit, really, and I think that it's good for him to still have a kind of target that's way off in the distance that he has to shoot for and he has to aspire to. But, you know, L'Équipe have still got a sort of a school trip to a cheese museum in his first year at Lycée that they haven't done a double page spread on yet, because they've covered absolutely everything else this week. There was an article yesterday, or a large section of an article, I think it was yesterday, dedicated to how good his eyesight is. That has been the level of L'Équipe's blanket coverage of Paul Sexas this week.
Do you mean he was at the front and he turned round and he could see through 180 riders and he could see Pogacar was at the back?
Literally, this article was talking about how good he was at looking around the peloton and how it's sort of, how sharp his vision was.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because let's face it, after that result, you would be very surprised if Decathlon decided to announce that he was not going to be selected for the Tour de France. So this is going to split people. Some people will say it's too soon, he's too young. Shelley Versis, who was a soigneur in the 80s, made the point that, you know, back in the day, 21 was considered too young to take on an event as kind of arduous and relentless as the Tour de France. I do think that the sport has changed. It's still obviously an endurance sport, but it's now so much punchier and intense. And he's clearly showing that he can live with the very best in the world. And that age is just a number. And yes, there'll be pressure on him. Psychologically, it might be quite tricky, but that pressure is never going to calm down. It's only going to get worse. And I think if they put him into the race and he can go toe-to-toe with Pogacar for a good chunk of it, he's going to learn about himself. He's going to learn about the race. The team are going to learn how to kind of insulate him from the excesses of that spotlight. I think it would be kind of daft not to have a go, see how it turns out. He's not obliged to go all the way to Paris if it isn't going, you know, if it's kind of unraveling or getting away from him, or he has a really tricky time. There's nothing wrong with saying after 10 days, well, we've exposed him to the Tour, we've seen what he can do, we've learned, we'll go away and we'll come back. Because I just think it would be, we're obviously going to be interested in what happens. But from the point of view of the rider, I just don't think that the old school sort of mentality of he's too young, I don't think that necessarily applies these days.
Well, Lionel, we know the decision is supposed to fall this evening, or certainly in the next few hours. Who knows, in his post-race interviews today, which we haven't seen yet, maybe he has announced that he is going to do the Tour de France. The team have decided to send him to the Tour de France. As we know, Lionel, the rise of Paul Sexas has been closely followed in France by Emmanuel Macron. He's been on the podcast. I was lucky enough to catch up with him after the finish. He was just finishing today. The other day was his Super Lognon. Today he was just polishing off his Coq au Vin, washed down with a glass of Côte du Rhône. I asked him whether he thinks Paul Sexas should go to the Tour de France. This is what he said.
For sure.
There you have it, Lionel. There you have it. Who knows whether that'll be Emmanuel Macron's last appearance on the podcast this spring. We've given him plenty of airtime.
feature length interview next time,
yeah.
Please, Daniel.
Yeah. But Lionel, of course, we talk about the decision of whether or not he should go to the Tour de France. We talked about that in the Kilometre Zero Sexy Basque, which is sort of the week of Sexas's coming of age at the Tour of the Basque Country. That's out at the moment if you want to listen to it. Free at the moment, free, but it will be go behind the, as you put it, Lionel, the Berlin Wall, the cycling podcast Berlin Wall soon enough. But Lionel, serious question. I've been thinking about what Sexas's presence and what his emergence might mean for Tadej Pogacar, good or bad. And, you know, I've been thinking about the sort of euphoria that this is going to whip up if he does go to the Tour de France, and the euphoria of the French fans. And Pogacar is at the point, some would argue that he's well beyond the point in his reign, where there already is quite a bit of hostility towards him, or a bit of sort of apathy on the part of the French public, or boredom with him winning. And if you add in someone for the home crowds to get behind after 41 years of them not winning the Tour de France, that is obviously potentially a negative for Pogacar. Positive aspects of it, well, it might give him, not that he needs any kind of second wind, but if there was ever any danger, and we talked last year about this sort of ennui maybe having kicked in with him, if he needs a sort of impetus for the second part of his career, third act of his career, then maybe this could be it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'd not really considered that. Yeah, he could be the kind of the villain, couldn't he, of the Tour de France, if he cracks Sexas and ruins the dream debut.
I said today on Twitter, as of today, he'll be buying his tennis balls from Intersport, not Decathlon.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the racing dynamic, it might be quite welcome for Pogacar, though, because it does break up the duopoly between him and Vingegaard. You know, they watch each other so closely, they kind of ride, you know, especially in that second half of the Tour de France last year, they were kind of, you know, obsessed with one another to the point of, you know, almost stalemate, weren't they, really? I mean, Vingegaard will have more to think about, Pogacar will have more to think about, and Sexas will be an unknown quantity at this stage. So it's going to make that dynamic more interesting. But yes, the one who kind of lands the decisive blow to wreck Sexas's chances will be public enemy number one, I suspect, in France. And so there might be a little standoff between Vingegaard and Pogacar, who wants to make themselves the public enemy number one. That could be very interesting to observe in July.
And if this duality, this rivalry, if it does materialise between Pogacar and Sexas, we always love to paint in pretty broad brushstrokes. We love these dichotomies when it's a rivalry. We love to sort of accentuate the character traits of one and the opposing character traits of the other. And with Vingegaard, that works. It's pretty easy to do because Vingegaard is this kind of introverted figure versus Pogacar has become more and more extroverted and more flamboyant as the years have gone on. And our sort of sense at the moment, on the bike at least, the way they think about cycling, the way they sort of interpret cycling, Sexas seems to be a bit of an analogue of Pogacar. And that's how he sees himself, as someone who is just going to attack continually, no fear, going to be very daring, not very calculating. We'll see. I mean, he's 19. It could change in a matter of weeks.
It could. Shall we just run through some of Pog's numbers? I mean, three in a row at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, four in total. The three in a row, he's the first man since Moreno Argentin in the mid-1980s to win three editions of Liège in a row, the men's race. Eddie Merckx did it before that, and Leon Uwe, who won in 1892, 93 and 94, won the first three editions of Liège. So quite exclusive company there. He joins Valverde and Argentine on four wins, just one behind Eddie Merckx on five. He's the only man other than Merckx to win Milan-San Remo, Flanders and Liège in the same year. Merckx did it in 69 and 75. And the monument totaliser currently stands Merckx 19, Pogacar 13. I was wondering what Pogacar's chances of equaling or overtaking Merckx and having that record outright is, because it's still quite a long way, isn't it? I mean, he may well ride Lombardy at the end of the season, could go six in a row there, but, you know, that remains to be seen. He's still going to have to clock up two or three monuments a year for another few seasons to get close and then overtake. So I think that puts into sort of context the extraordinary numbers that Merckx posted, and the fact that Pogacar is even in the same conversation is remarkable.
Yeah. Lombardy is becoming for Pogacar what San Remo was for Merckx, in his sort of monument farming efforts. He sort of goes to Lombardy and it feels like it's almost, well, it's a foregone conclusion. So you would expect him to win that again today. I think, you know, we are definitely in danger of becoming blasé about Pogacar, and today he was expected to win, and he did pretty much what everyone expected. Okay, Sexas's performance was maybe a pleasant surprise. But I think today was probably, in terms of execution, it was one of his greatest rides, Pogacar. Mm. And I think we're in danger of overlooking that, because it was sort of surgical the way he got rid of, well, the rest, first of all, and then Sexas on the Rochefoucauld. If you look at the number, if we look at the numbers, and people are already publishing them on social media in terms of the times on La Redoute, I think it was his fastest time, faster than last year on La Redoute by about 15 seconds. So I think we are seeing, and we said it at the start of this year, he's 27. That is the age when typically bike riders get the best results of their career. I think we are seeing Pogacar at his absolute peak at the moment, which again is tribute to Sexas's efforts today and how good Sexas is and how good Sexas is going to be. But I think it would be remiss of us not to acknowledge that. And also, the classic season that Pogacar has had, 3 out of 4 monuments. And I was trying to think, Lionel, was there some adversity? Because in three of them, San Remo, Paris-Roubaix, and this one, there have been moments of major adversity when, again, an underrated ability of Pogacar's, the ability to stay cool and to negotiate difficult, sticky situations, has come to the fore. Because in San Remo, of course, he had the crash before the Cipressa, which, you know, it looked as though he was down and out. Then in Paris-Roubaix, he had the puncture before Arenberg, again, 25 kilometers chasing. And then today, again, when we logged on to internet this morning and saw that he was 4 minutes behind Evenepoel, nearly 4 minutes behind Evenepoel, again, we thought, well, he needs a miracle. It wasn't really the reality of the situation, but he has overcome the odds in three of these monuments.
Yeah, very much reminds me of what I said after Strada Bianca, where he really, it was just one hammer blow and he won in the same manner that he'd won previous times. I thought, yeah, you said surgical. I think he was incredibly precise today, you know, and his experience not to panic. You know, he might have expected to be completely alone after La Redoute with the power of the attack. But he didn't panic and think, well, I've got to shake off Sexas here. There's still further opportunities. And he took that opportunity on the Rochefoucauld. But it would have been really interesting to see, if he hadn't managed to get away on his own, what that run-in would have been like. It would have got cagey. They wouldn't have got caught, I don't think, because the gap was big enough. But it would have been a rare unknown for Pogacar, because I don't really know. Do you know what Sexas is like in a flat sprint?
He's quick purely by virtue of, as we said the other day, purely by virtue of the fact that he's so strong. But you're right, we don't really know.
And it would have been a risk. You know, so he had to make that move stick on the Rochefoucauld. So, you know, it wasn't a case of just, I think I called the Tour of Flanders victory slightly paint by numbers, because he's done exactly that before. This time, you know, he had to make the moves decisive. You know, he shed everybody bar Sexas, and then he had to make sure that he didn't leave anything to chance at the finish, because it would have been a sensational result. And it would all have been, I guess, about how Pogacar was beaten rather than how Sexas won it, simply because the odds would have been in Pogacar's favour. So it was a thrilling finale. The TV focused a bit more on Group Evenepoel for my liking in that finale, but we kind of knew once Pogacar was away that was it done.
Pogacar's closing gambit in his post-race interview about Sexas: you guys need to take care of him.
Interesting.
Something else that we've talked about, I've certainly talked about a lot on the podcast in recent years, a key facet of the Pogacar phenomenon, one of the reasons why he's managed to get to where he's got, is being from Slovenia has been very advantageous for him, because the size of that country, the nature of the following, the size of the following, and he's really been left alone to a large extent, and that's going to be very different for Sexas. And it's interesting that Pogacar, I mean, you'd have to be blind not to see it, but he certainly has already perceived the danger of the hype around Sexas.
Well, Sexas can't really move to Monaco in order to escape and kind of, you know, lock himself away, because it's basically France anyway, and he'd be training in France. And so, yeah, you're right. He's going to be in a goldfish bowl, isn't he? And that's something for the team and the people around him to be aware of. But I don't know. I've seen him talking, and obviously, listening to Sexy Basque. You know, his pre-race interview was very confident. You know, he was talking about how good he felt and what he could do in the race, and I don't know, there's a sort of a sense of feeling, looking and seeming quite assured. But as I said in last week's episode, the Flesh Wallone episode, the real crunch is when he's under pressure, when he's expected to deliver and then doesn't or can't for whatever reason. And oddly, I think that's the sort of position that Remco Evenepoel's in now. And well, back to your question has it been a good spring?
Shall we look at that? Because it's really interesting if you just go down the results. I mean, he's raced a lot, 25 days, and he had that sort of rip-roaring start where he won his first three races in the Challenge Mallorca, and then in Valencia, he was dominant as well. He won the general classification. UAE Tour was the first sort of disappointment, in the sense that, okay, he won the time trial, but he was 10th on GC and not maybe as good as we thought or he would have hoped in the climbing stages. Catalunya, similarly, at that point when he did Catalunya, we didn't know, of course, that he was doing the Tour of Flanders, and that actually he might have had a bit of an eye on the Tour of Flanders. We thought that, again, it was a disappointing performance, particularly on the climbs there. He finished 5th on general classification, not bad. Then Tour of Flanders 3rd, exceeded expectations, I would suggest. Amstel Gold, he won that race. He was expected, I suppose, to win it. He was the outstanding favourite. And then Liège 3rd, behind Sexas and Pogacar, which is the result a lot of people would have predicted yesterday, but probably not in the fashion that people would have predicted or his fans would have hoped.
Yeah, there's always this question mark with Evenepoel at the moment, isn't there? Because even in Catalunya, notwithstanding the fact that he wasn't, you know, tip-top, it was all about the rivalry and is he getting on with Lipovic, wasn't it? You know, there's this sense of, is he even the number one figure in that team? How is it going to play out? And I think the fact that he went to the Tour of Flanders and got such a good result, you know, a good result behind two riders who, you know, were on another level to him on the day, you know, that reflected well on him. I mean, he raced well, and, you know, was dogged, determined, and was involved in a sort of fruitless chase, wasn't he? Amstel Gold's tricky because it wasn't the best field of the spring. It felt a little bit sort of watered down, really, especially compared to what we'd seen at Milan-San Remo, Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. And today, you're right, the third place result, you would think, he would be satisfied with that. But the key thing was the moment that mattered, he wasn't even there to react. He'd already gone backwards. Mm. And it's all very well digging in and salvaging a third place, a very good third place, but that is it. It's a salvaged result. It's not one that he's created. It's not one. And to not even be there to not react to Pogacar and success, I think was the bigger disappointment.
Yeah, and obviously he's changed teams this year. He's gone to a team that's, according to him, well, he talked about wanting a change, but this team is supposed to elevate him. It's supposed to be a better team than the team he was at. It's a richer team. It's got more talent. And they have lived up to that in terms of the way they've ridden with him. And generally, they've had a good start to the season. But they haven't really elevated him. And I would suggest that everything we've seen from him this year has been more or less aligned with what we've seen in the past. He hasn't suggested to me that he's gone to a different dimension. And I suppose that then raises the question of what happens next. And if you look at his race program, the next race he's supposed to do is the Dauphiné. So now he goes to altitude and he starts preparing for the Tour de France, as, you know, Pogacar after Romandie will. And Remco will probably say that he's going to lose weight and he's going to focus more on climbing and he's going to kind of be a different rider when he emerges in June. But I don't know, I just find myself wondering, is Ralf Denk, the man who wanted him for years and has spent millions to get him, I mean, how will he be feeling about Remco's spring?
Yeah, because, you know, go back to those back-to-back editions of Liège-Bastogne-Liège that he won, 2022 and 2023. I mean, he won at the first attempt. You know, he was the kind of Pogacar sexass figure of those two editions, wasn't he? Almost unbeatable. Winning, you know, in convincing style by 48 seconds ahead of Quinten Hermans in 22 and by over a minute ahead of Pidcock in 23 with, you know, hammer blow attacks. We saw the fragility last year when, you know, Pogacar was clearly much stronger, but Remco sort of threw in the towel. So I suppose today he was, you talked about the similarity in the moment that he faltered, but he didn't throw in the towel at all today. You know, he fought back and he was frustrated that there wasn't a bit more cooperation, but I don't think it would have made any difference. You know, and no one was going to give him too much of a hand at that point. But it's one of those, isn't it? When you get to that level, third place in a Liège-Bastogne-Liège, having won it twice before, feels like a disappointment.
Yeah, and now looks as though he's sort of been overtaken as well. You might have thought, well, okay, he's not as good as Pogacar, but if ever Pogacar is not going to be there, then Remco is the next man in. But to look as though that Sexas has now given him a haircut as well is not great news, I don't think.
The trouble for Evenepoel is he's not quite a Grand Tour rider. I know he's won the Vuelta, but he's can you really see him winning the Tour de France, especially with the arrival of Sexas now and the way Pogacar is? You know, Evenepoel's 26 now. You know, he is in the peak years. It's now that he needs to sort of step up to that level. And I think he's a little bit adrift. And then in the biggest one-day races, he can win them, but he's, you know, suffering from the same thing that whole generation of riders suffered in the Eddy Merckx era, which is being the second best rider in the world is pretty useless at times. And, you know, that must eventually kind of start to play with his head. And it would be fascinating to know what they were thinking today when he was in that position. Mm. It's sort of almost stuck in that group of 50, because as we said earlier, didn't have enough support to really press home any advantage, but couldn't sort of sit up and say, well, we'll give back 3 or 4 minutes. But it was kind of it was no man's land, really, wasn't it? So it didn't work out for him tactically, and it certainly didn't work out for him when the pressure went right on Laredoux.
All of this, of course, is relative to our expectations, and he's not responsible for what we expect of him. I mean, he's still an absolutely outstanding rider, one of the best riders in the world. He's just
absolutely. Yeah. But it's, you know, peak Tiger Woods finishing fifth in the Masters. It's Real Madrid losing in the Champions League quarterfinal. You know, this is elite, the elite of the elite. And so he's not on the same level as Pogacar and Sexas. And, you know, he's Belgian. There's a heck of a lot of expectation on his shoulders. You know, the crowds were there for him as well. And, you know, he must wish that he'd been around in a sort of Philippe Gilbert type era where, I mean, he would have racked up four or five wins in Liège by now, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Lionel, is that just about the conclusion of our men's Arrivé episodes for this spring? Obviously, there are other performances today that probably merit some examination, but I think you're going to do an episode. I'm going to take a week off before the Giro d'Italia, because it's going to be obviously a very intense period, including the week before the Giro d'Italia. There'll be podcasts, I think, every day of some form. This week already on Tuesday, we talked about this the other day. Today is the 40th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster. On Tuesday, I'm going to release a special episode. We're going to release a special episode called Meltdown, which coincides with the day when the world found out about the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, so the 28th. Why is this relevant to cycling? Well, 10 days later in Kyiv, 90 kilometers away, Kyiv now the Ukrainian capital, the peace race started under a real radioactive cloud and sort of metaphorical cloud as well. And we're releasing a two-part series about that race and the aftermath and the implications. So the first part is coming out on Tuesday and it's called Meltdown.
Indeed. Yes, there will be an episode this week. I'll get myself into the break somehow. There's a very important appointment for the world of cycling on Tuesday, I gather, I should be attending. More on that in the coming days. You'll be preparing for the Giro d'Italia in your sort of podcasting tour of the Alps this week, I guess.
Already prepared, Lionel. I'm tapering now. Pressing send now.
Perfect. Just before we wrap up on Liège, though, I did just want to mention something. Rob Hatch made several references to this in his commentary today. Tadej Pogacar was wearing a black armband, a tribute to his former teammate Christian Munoz, who rode for UAE Team Emirates the same year that Pogacar turned professional for them. He crashed in the Tour de Jura and suffered a knee injury and then travelled with his team to Spain to take part in another race and was checked into hospital because he had an infection and complications, and then tragically died on Friday in hospital in northern Spain. A really shocking and tragic story, that. And clearly it was on Pogacar's mind. He pointed to the sky as he crossed the line. And so, yeah, our condolences to everyone who knew Christian Munoz. Something about that. I mean, you know, riders have been involved in fatal accidents in cycling too often in recent years, but to have a seemingly fairly innocuous crash and then suffer an infection like that, and for it to be so serious, really quite sort of shocked me this afternoon when I realised the implication of that.
Mm. Indeed. Well, Lionel, that concludes the Arrivé episodes for the spring, concludes the spring classics season. Tour Romandy starts on Tuesday. I think Tadej Pogacar has got a decent chance of doing okay in that. So best of
luck. Going from sort of Disneyland to Butlins, that's really harsh.
Tour Romandy is a very distinguished race in a beautiful part of the world.
It is, but it looks like it looks completely unpopulated. It's beautiful to look at, isn't it? Very green, probably rain all week, because it always does. I'm really selling it.
Raining Pogacar victories. Anyway, Lionel, that's this week. I'll be back the week after next, and you'll be hearing from Lionel in the next couple of days.
And the women's episode of Arrivé, covering Liège-Bastogne-Liège, will be out soon. Rose Manley joined by Lizzie Banks, who's stepping in at very short notice because Rebecca Charlton is unwell. So thank you, Lizzie, and get well soon, Rebecca.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.